Chapter 22. Jester can't quite tear his eyes away from the sleek lines and warm glow of the crystal set into his new armor. There are a thousand things to do in the aftermath of the wedding and Agacast's attack, enough that Jester dragged himself out of bed and away from John's warm, tempting body well before the sun rose, but... Kyber, he thinks, rubbing his thumb across the elegant edges of the cut stone, still awed by it. He's never actually seen a Kyber crystal in person before, though he's heard tales, read accounts. Just the other day, he spent hours in bed with John, trying to wring out Jedi knowledge, and the peculiarities of Kyber was one of the most confusing, most intriguing. It's more beautiful than Jaster would have expected, just hearing about it. The glow is soft, strangely ethereal for so solid a thing, and Jaster tips the Vambrace, watches the play of light across the facets. John was wearing bits of green crystal in his hair, he thinks, and smiles. Chips of Kyber, set to pins, and threaded through the dark strands. How like a Jedi, to wear a planetary fortune in their hair so easily, and give their new spouse a crystal that could buy a whole system as if it were just another gesture of affection. You'll wear it out with your eyes if you keep staring at it, Miles says, droll. It's Kyber, Jaster counters, and doesn't bother raising his gaze. Nothing you or I do in 1,000 years could wear it out in any way. Miles sighs, put upon, though Jaster knows him more than well enough to read the amusement in it, in the way he gently places a pair of pads on the desk beside Jaster. I should have told him to just make a fake Vambrace out of his patched old robes. Maybe then you'd actually be able to get some work done. If John had made me a gift out of his own clothes, I would have treasured it forever, Jaster says promptly, and finally looks up, though it takes effort to pull his gaze away from the crystal. It makes him think of John's blade in the sunlight, the way John moved, powerful and quick and elegant, in a way that his quiet demeanor and the way he holds himself normally hides. John never straightens to his full height, never makes himself imposing when he's among allies. Tries to slip back, let attention pass over him, eyes move onwards. But that moment in the fight, he'd been something else entirely. Commanding and beautiful, and so blindingly sure of every inch of himself that it took Jaster's breath away. He's already fielded more than one Mandalorian guest from the wedding trying to ask, subtle and mildly abashed, just how and where Jaster managed to find himself a Jedi. Jaster can hardly blame them after John's showing, after all the Jedi's showing. Miles is staring at him, entirely unimpressed. Mandalore, he says dryly. You're mooning. It's going to get all over the paperwork. I'm married, Jaster defends. But he reaches for the next pad, manages by sheer force of will not to get distracted by the way the Kyber flickers in the early morning sunlight. It's already cruel and unusual punishment to make me work when my husband is still sleeping in our bed. Of course, Mandalore, Miles says, and drops 3 more pads on top of the pile. Jaster slants him an exasperated look, but flips through the first few pages of a report. He keeps his tone carefully mild when he says, I'm surprised I was able to drag you out of bed to come help me. Jango mentioned that you spent quite a stretch of time after dinner with the Bothan Jedi. Jango should know better than to gossip about things he has no idea about, Miles says, though from the way his eyes narrow faintly, that's definitely not going to be the end of things. Jaster would feel sorry for setting Miles on his son, but... Well, Jango generally deserves it in some fashion, at least. I hope she was interesting, at least, Jaster offers, and Miles snorts. Not in the way you'd prefer, he says, and then, like he can't stop himself, do you remember those bandits we were contacted about a few years ago, the ones harassing the Bothan sector? Jaster blinks, but he does, more or less. The true Mandalorians don't receive a lot of contract offers that large. John had mentioned something about Venari and bandits, too, if he remembers right. The one I turned down because of Tor trying to bomb all of Kel'Dabi? I do. Was she part of the force the Republic sent after them? Miles' mouth curves, though he's clearly trying not to look too invested. She was the force the Republic sent after them. A whole fleet of Wookiee bandits trying to take over her home system, and she beat all of them. Bothans call her the Fire Eater now. Given the way she used flamethrowers against their wielders and didn't even blink, Jaster isn't surprised. He isn't overly surprised that Miles is transfixed, either. That sort of wide-ranging destruction and bold confidence has always been the key to Miles' heart. He opens his mouth to make a joke about the next wedding Miles plans being his own. Null is quite impressive, isn't she? A woman's soft voice asks, right where it shouldn't be when Jaster absolutely should have heard the door open. He startles hard, wrenching to his feet with his blaster in hand, and feels slightly better when Miles has precisely the same reaction, whipping around towards the small, slim figure of the Sephi Jedi from yesterday, like she just appeared out of thin air. "Hells," Jaster says, and forces himself to lower his blaster. John had seemed close to her, and even beyond that, she claimed to be Tare Vizsla's student. She's likely not a threat, at least to Jaster and his people. Given the way the Vizslas have used the darksaber they took from the Jedi Temple, Jaster isn't entirely willing to write her off as a threat to the Death Watch just yet. Then, belatedly, he realizes that she's here, standing in his office, and says, "Jedi Master Fae, I was very certain you'd left in the middle of the night." Fae raises one elegant brow, waving the door shut behind her as she steps further into the room. "There was a fire in the closest town. I went to help. Forgive me for not informing you, Mandalore." She doesn't sound like she particularly cares about his forgiveness, Jaster thinks, amused, and holsters his blaster, then sinks back against the edge of the desk. "I would say that's the sort of thing you should clear with Governor Cast, not me, but given everything that's happened, it's probably best left to the local government, and I'm sure they were glad to have you." Fae doesn't seem like she particularly cares about that, either. "The people welcome me once they realize my purpose," she says, and her gray eyes flicker down, settling on the glow of the kyber between Jaster's fingers. A little wary, Jaster watches her face, but she's hard to read. After 1,000 years alive, Jaster likely shouldn't be surprised. "Kyber is quite the gift," she says after a long moment, and steps close, entirely ignoring Miles to curl a hand around Jaster's vambrace, tugging it up between them. Her fingers ghost, light, over the facets of the crystal, but she doesn't look up. "Did you know, Mandalore, that kyber crystals taken unwillingly can bend the force to bring ill luck down upon those who try to use them, or pry their secrets out of them?" Something prickles down the line of Jaster's spine, instinct offering a cold warning as he stares down at the top of Fae's bowed head. She's a tiny woman, even for a Sephi, slight, with bird-like bones and an ethereal feeling all about her, but that was something of a threat, and Jaster's stomach turns at the memory of mindless men and women, blank of every bit of themselves, who are currently in the medical ward and waiting to be handed back over to their families. "John told me it was semi-sentient," he says, as evenly as he can manage. "I suppose it's logical that a force-sensitive crystal would be able to use the force to that extent." Fae hums, framing the crystal between her fingers. "Kyber only reacts to living things," she says. "Press a piece of metal to it, and it won't react. But brush it with a fingertip, and it warms." A pause, and she tips her head up, meeting Jaster's eyes squarely. "They react to kindness and goodwill, too, Mandalore. There's a reason the Sith needed to torture their kyber to make the crystals serve them during the wars." Wars she saw, Jaster thinks, and breathes out. "It will find a safe home with me," he says quietly, holding her gaze. "And if it's called elsewhere, I will send it off myself." That, at least, makes her smile faintly, blue mouth tipping. "You won't have a choice," she tells him, and finally steps back. "Kyber is stronger than stars. It carries the Order's future." They're most certainly not talking about Kyber, Jaster reflects. Not that he minds, but she could very much just come out and say what she wants to. I'll keep it in mind, Master Fay. Your wisdom is appreciated. Fay hums, light, and catches his other hand, presses his fingertips to the Kyber without any apparent concern for personal space or etiquette. Were you aware that Kyber can change color to suit the one who holds it? She asks, and this time her smile is something fuller, truer. Warm, Jaster thinks, startled, then surprised that he's startled. She's a healer, John said, and a kind person, but this is the first time she's looked like what he would have imagined that to be, just hearing about her. A second later, what she actually said registers, and Jaster blinks, interest flickering. Is that why the Darksaber is the color it is? He asks. I had always wondered if it was Kyber, and how it was manipulated to produce that color, but obviously House Vizsla was never overly interested in answering my questions. Fay shakes her head, expression slipping into something fond, soft in a way that's startling. No, she says. My master found the crystal he used on Concordia, near where he was born. Down in the heart of a Beskar mine, he said. Kyber isn't the only thing that can be used at the heart of a lightsaber, though it's the most reliable. The Darksaber's crystal is something that none of the smiths in the temple had ever seen before, but Tare decided he would use it and couldn't be swayed. He always said it called to him in a way nothing else did. That's why he took it back to Mandalore when he left the Order. Tare, Jaster thinks, and has to close his eyes for a moment, feeling a little like the whole world is turning under his feet. Fay knows what Tare Vizsla thought, because she lived alongside him, was trained by him, grew up in his care. She knew Tare Vizsla in a way that seems utterly impossible, given the figure that Tare is now, in this time. 1,000 years ago, though, he was just a man. An incredible man, singular, but a Jedi, a Mandalorian, a warrior, a mentor. It makes Jaster feel winded and small and so vastly, blasted, hopeful all at once. Just a man who became Mandalore before, ending all the clan conflict. Tare was a special man, but even so, it gives Jaster hope that he might be able to end this war someday, too. When he opens his eyes again, Fay is watching him, thoughtful. Master Tare would have appreciated your Super Commando Codex, she says after a moment. One thing he always despaired of was the clans holding themselves to 1,000 different standards. I only visited him a few times when he was Mandalore, but I heard that complaint every time I did. Jaster smiles, rueful. I'm as surprised as anyone that it was so widely adopted, he says, given my past especially. He pauses, casting a sideways, hopeful glance at Miles, who rolls his eyes but tips his head in agreement, and Jaster grins. Could I interest you in some caff and conversation, Master Fay? I was hoping to learn more about Tare's time as a Jedi. Many Mandalorian sources exist about his time as Mandalore, but we have almost none about his life at the temple. Understandable, Fay says, perfectly mild, given that his house stole his lightsaber from the temple during the fall of the Old Republic, while the temple was beset by the Sith. Jaster pauses, but John had said the same thing to Arla when they had spoken about it. Arla had passed on the conversation, knowing he'd be interested, and when asked, John had said that his master had spent years looking for it, only to fail to pick up even rumors of its location. You're sure it was stolen? He asks, frowning. After Tare's death, I know he bequeathed part of his fortune and some of his belongings to the Order, but I always heard that it was retrieved. I thought that meant Clan Vizsla asked for it to be returned. It was theft, Fay says flatly. Master Tare never intended to leave his lightsaber to anyone but the Jedi. We spoke of it directly, the last time I saw him before his death, and I was the one who carried his things back to the temple. She pauses, mouth tightening faintly, a blue slash in her face, and says quietly, After it was stolen, I never returned to the temple. 1,000 years wandering is quite a lot, even for a Jedi, Jaster would imagine. He breathes out, heavy, and rubs a hand over his chin, trying to put his thoughts in order. The Darksaber is a Jedi artifact, particularly if Tare left it to them, and Fae's word seems too certain for doubt. At the same time, it's been in Mandalorian hands for 1,000 years, and even beyond that, There's no way House Vizsla would give it over, especially if it was in the name of returning it to the Jedi. No Mandalorian is going to want to see the Darksaber shipped off to Coruscant to be locked away in a treasure vault in the Jedi Temple, Jaster says after a moment. It means far too much to the people of Mandalore. Faye raises a brow, unimpressed. It was never locked away anywhere, Mandalore. Tare was one of the lost 20 Jedi who left the Order as masters. There are busts of them in the archives, and Tare in particular had a statue in the Room of a Thousand Fountains. That's where the Darksaber was when House Vizsla stole it, in a place of honor where all Jedi could see it. A place of honor, because Tare was a Jedi as much as a Mandalorian. Jaster grimaces, but tips his head, and says quietly, I will see what I can do, Master Fae, but the true Mandalorians are at war with the Death Watch, and there's no way Tor will surrender the symbol of his power, particularly to me. Fae inclines her head. Simply the fact that you're willing to try means quite a lot to me, Mandalore, she says, just as quiet. It was Tare's last request that I take his blade back, and it's the only time I've ever carried a lightsaber in all my life. The only person I would carry one for, as well. I'd like to see that it was for a purpose. Jaster blinks. Only? He asks, and she hadn't used one during the fight before the wedding, but somehow, he thought that was simply because she was more focused on protecting the non-combatants. Is that usual for a Jedi? I thought the saber was a symbol of the Order. Miles sighs, deliberately audible. I'll get Calf, he says, and Jaster can hear the roll of his eyes. Dignified, Faye sinks down into the seat across from the desk, settling her robes around her. If I'm to undergo an interrogation, I would prefer tea, she says, and Miles, ever a vindictive bastard, smiles agreeably. A lady of taste, he says. I'll bring the tea. Just wait here, Mandalore. Jaster grimaces, but if Twigwater is the price he has to pay for access to a primary source from 1,000 years ago, he'll pay it. Willingly, even. Not that he's going to tell Miles that. I see Dark Woman still insists on instilling her disdain for the classical form in her apprentices, Dooku says, displeased, but he offers Jon a hand up from the grass as he slips his lightsaber through his sash. You're just cranky because he almost got you with that last move, Nico jeers, seated safely off to the side under a tree, with a platter of sweets on the rock beside him and a pot of calf wedged between a few roots. If you spent less time getting captured by Hutts and more time sparring, Dooku. Close your mouth, Nico, or I'll close it for you, Dooku says crossly. Jon, do you still have contact with your master? Jon hesitates, sliding his own lightsaber away, and glances at Nico, faintly wary. Not much, Master Dooku. Dooku frowns, but inclines his head. Nico said you mentioned a new Padawan, he says. A Paladuvan girl, I believe. For a second, Jon has no idea how to respond. It's true, he saw the girl in the background of their comm when Dark Woman contacted him about the Firehand gang, but Dark Woman takes on troublesome Padawans, students who might otherwise be removed from the Order. In all likelihood, Dark Woman found the girl after she was rejected by another master, took her on, and is training her. She could be the girl's last chance to be a Jedi. And Dark Woman is a good Jedi. She's utterly devoted to the Order. Her training is harsh, and Jon was always a poor student, but that's his own failing. Dark Woman has trained council members and masters and incredibly skilled Jedi. Jon simply wasn't good enough to master most things she taught him, or fully learn the lessons she offered. There's a small, guilty part of him, though, that feels uneasy, unsettled. The girl in the background of the comm was asleep, collapsed in a corner of the room in a way Jon remembers all too well. Pure exhaustion and overuse of the Force. The training must have been brutal, because Dark Woman's training is always brutal, and she was a young girl. 15, maybe, with a wealth of fire-red hair and long, skinny limbs. Jedi robes that didn't quite fit right. Seeing her there, Jon should have felt pleased to know that there would be another skilled Jedi soon, but he hadn't. Some part of him had felt afraid, the same sort of fear that comes with sudden movement near his face. Instinctive, bone deep, impossible to fight. John, Nico says, quiet, and all the mirth has faded from his face when he sits up straight, gaze pinning John in place. If we simply visited, it wouldn't disrupt the girls' training, would it? It wouldn't, technically, but Dark Woman doesn't like to let most people watch her training her problem students. Padawans like Ki-Adi-Mundi she trained in the temple, mostly, but he was a good student. She adores him. Students like John and a few of the others she's taken need different methods. She doesn't like other masters observing. It was her methods training John that drove a wedge between her and Nico last time. If the same thing happens again... John, Dooku says, quiet, calm. And when John raises his gaze, there's something strange on Dooku's face, something he can't read. I've been offered a seat on the council. Is it something you wouldn't want me to see, the way Dark Woman trains her students? Nico raises a brow, but doesn't comment. Dark Woman is a good Jedi, fiercely loyal to the Order. There's no way she could be anything else. John swallows, but after a second, he shakes his head and says, it was the Bellsmith sector. Bodajev, I think. Thank you, John, Dooku says, and turns, sweeping towards Nico, then leaning down to grab his arm and pull him to his feet. Stop lazing about. We have places to be, now that everything here is settled. Nico makes an indignant sound, though he doesn't resist the manhandling in any way. Watch your hands, you know precisely where I'm sore. And what's this about you accepting the council's offer? I thought you planned to spit in the Senate's face again and live as a simple master. Do you really imagine I'm as uncouth as you? Dooku asks witheringly, though the tips of his ears are noticeably red. Up. The sooner we leave, the sooner we can return. I'm going. Nico spares a glance over his shoulder for John and says, pointed, we will be back, John. Don't get into any more firefights before then, all right? Dooku needs all the practice he can get blocking blaster bolts. Just because Makashi is more elegant and civilized than Shicho, it most certainly is not. John hides his flicker of amusement, sinking down under the tree Nico abandoned as they retreat. A small, guilty part of him thinks he should calm Dark Woman and warn her, but if Dooku really is going to be on the council, he's going to have the right to assess a Padawan's training soon regardless. There's no reason to worry. He just feels torn in a way he hadn't expected. Dark Woman is a loyal Jedi, and John's training was harsh because he was a poor student. The Paladuvan girl might be too. But still, even knowing that, something in John's stomach turns at the thought of the girl he glimpsed gaining scars the way John did, dragging herself through the training he endured. Some part of him is just scared to think what might happen to her. Breathing out, he rubs his hands over his face, closes his eyes. It's fine. Dark Woman will be fine. The girl is probably all right, too. She just needs to work hard and become a good Jedi. That's all. John, Arla calls, and John raises his head, startled, too caught up in his thoughts and worries to have noticed her approach. Hers and Jango's, because they're together, both in full armor, and Arla, at least, is almost vibrating with a contained sort of energy that has John rising to his feet immediately. Arla, he asks, concerned, is everything all right? Arla grins, wolfish. We got a hit on the omen yesterday, just before the wedding, she says, and John stills. Silas got confirmation this morning. The omen stopped on Harsby for a night and unloaded cargo. Heavily guarded cargo. They took it up to an old crusader fortress in the hills. The Harsby system is squarely within the Death Watch's territory, John thinks, and looks from Arla to Jango. That's where Tor is hiding the Darksaber then, he says quietly. Jango nods, settling his helmet under one arm. His smirk is just as dangerous as Arla's grin. Still think you can find us a way in, JT? Jaster's locked up with that old Jedi lady, so if we're going to sneak out, now's the time. Jaster likely won't approve of them risking themselves to retrieve a simple symbol, particularly one that he doesn't need to prove his claim as Mandalore. It's not right that Tor keeps the blade, though, and everything in John says that this is the right decision. The pull of the Force is turning, aiming his feet toward the Harsby system, and John can feel it like the shift of gravity, stepping off a ship and onto a planet with a non-standard pull. "I can get us into the fortress," he says, and knows it's true without a moment's doubt, "as long as you can get us there." Arla nods, short, sharp, and catches John's arm, dragging him along as she and Django turn towards the landing area. "I've got just the person to get us through the air defenses," she says, and waves. At the very edge of the garden, awkward and clearly out of place, Ursa Wren watches the gesture and smiles crookedly, nodding to John as they approach. "JT," she says, and then pauses like she's been caught. "Night Antilles, I mean." "Whatever you want to call me is fine," John says, a little awkward. "You're..." Ursa hesitates, then tightens her grip on her golden helmet. "Tor set me and my clan up," she says quietly. "We were a diversion, and he didn't even warn us. If Jaster was anyone else, he would have executed us the moment the attack ended. So, if he's willing to keep my clan safe, I'll help him get the Darksaber from Tor." It's not a small thing for a vassal clan like Clan Wren to turn on the house they're sworn to. John meets her eyes, then dips his head in a short bow and says, "Jaster will, I'm sure, and I will too." That, at least, makes Ursa smile. "I saw you protecting Duke Kreese and his daughters," she says. "That promise means quite a lot. Thank you, JT." She takes a breath, then glances at Arla and pulls her helmet on. "I can get you through the air defenses, but I don't have the authority to get anyone into the keep." "That's fine," Arla says, clasping her shoulder and pulling her onwards. "That's what we've got the JT for." "Aren't you glad you signed up for this?" Django asks sardonically, but he follows willingly as well, and John snorts, pulling his hood up as he keeps pace. "Is Jaster going to think we've been kidnapped again?" he asks. "Probably," Django says. "Arla and I decided we're going to steal your clothes and send you out naked when we get back. That should distract him." John flushes, dragging his hood down to hide his face, and ignores the way Django laughs at him. There's no way to keep his dignity if he answers. End of chapter 22.